Hi, I'm Misha Ketchell, editor of The Conversation. For democracy to work, people need to be well informed. That's why we work with academic experts to share their research and explain issues in the news. Everything we do is free to republish, but we need your support. Please donate to The Conversation by going to donate.theconversation.com or following the link in the show notes.
Hello and welcome to The Conversation's Politics Podcast. I'm Michelle Grattan. Darren Chester is one of a rare breed in federal politics, a federal national from Victoria. He holds the seat of Gippsland and he's Parliamentary Secretary for Defence, and he's regarded as one of the party's up-and-comers. He joins us today. Darren Chester, the Prime Minister has promised an improved government performance and has also been trying to busily scrape off the barnacles. Do you think this has impressed voters out there, or is there still a long way for the government to go?
Well, good morning, Michelle. And I must say I had the opportunity last week in my electorate of Gippsland to meet literally thousands of people, because I was on the pre-poll for a Gippsland South by-election, and a lot of people came up and, as you'd expect, they gave me plenty of free advice. And the advice I received was they want us to just get on with the job of governing, to start focusing on the issues that they're concerned navel-gazing or politicking amongst colleagues has to stop, and that's the advice they gave me. So they're very keen to see the Prime Minister change in the way he has demonstrated he wants to. The decision on the Medicare co-payment, I think, was a good practical example that the Prime Minister has listened to people's concerns and has been willing to change. The decision in relation to the Australian Defence Force pay is another example where the Prime Minister has demonstrated he's heard people's concerns and he's going to be prepared to change and act accordingly. So I think they're keen for us to get on with the job of governing, and they're also keen to see what the opposition, in this case Bill Shorten, what they're prepared to do to help the government get on the job of fixing up the economy.
This week we've seen the defeat of the university's deregulation package. Will that defeat be welcomed in regional areas, or was that policy being sold okay?
Well, the regional universities network have supported the government's attempts to deregulate the university sector, so it had support of the regional universities, and that is an issue that I think the Labor Party needs to reconcile itself with in terms of in the general public. There's broad acceptance across the community, and I think across the university sector, that reform is required. Even Labor Party members have acknowledged that. Now, Bill Shorten has put himself in an invidious position here. He continues to oppose everything, even though his former colleagues, some as recently as only in the last government, Craig Emerson, have come out and supported university deregulation. I'm not sure how much longer Mr. Shorten can continue to oppose everything when he has to acknowledge that reform is required in the university sector.
So you'll be quite happy for Christopher Pyne to press on with this reform and indeed demonstrate that he is a fixer, as he puts it.
Well, there's one thing about Christopher Pyne as minister. He has an incredible capacity to bounce back. I don't think this particular legislation is finished. He'll bring it back. He'll continue to negotiate. We have to work with the crossbenchers in the Senate in good faith. We have to explain to them why it's important, and we haven't been that successful over the last 18 months necessarily in that area, so we're going to have to work and redouble our efforts in that regard. It's a pretty difficult Senate to work with when you have so many different competing priorities. There's no block of votes there to deal with now, so there's a lot of independent senators there, all of whom have their own priorities, their own policy areas that they're focused on, and we need to explain and work with them as much as we possibly can. And negotiations will go on in relation to this piece of legislation, and I'm confident that eventually we will get a result. I mean, the alternative is, of course, the Labor Party could actually do something constructive and help us. The Australian Labor Party has a choice here. They can actually contribute and be part of the solution, or continue to be obstructionist, but that's a call that Bill Shorten needs to make.
Another alternative would be for the government to go back and have an inquiry and try and build consensus that way.
Well, and that's a fair enough point. I mean, the university sector, right across the university sector, almost without exception, there is support for a deregulation process. So I'm not sure what an inquiry would prove. There's been countless inquiries over the years. This is the only policy on the table. That's the problem that the Australian Labor Party has today. It doesn't have any policies on the table for people to compare the two competing ideologies, if you like. The Nationals and Liberals in coalition are working with the university sector, trying to set up for the sustainability of our universities into the future. But at the moment, all we're getting is a blanket no from the Labor Party.
Now, thinking about the coalition, do you think that the Nationals' voice is being heard strongly enough within that coalition?
Oh, undoubtedly. We're an interesting political organisation, the coalition. We come from disparate parts of the nation, and we pulled together in our coalition party room. So there's always going to be areas of friction, if you like, where we have competing priorities. The Nationals ourselves come from all parts of Australia. There's 21 members and senators in the National Party now. That's grown significantly since the 2007 election, and we're very proud of our growth. But we need to earn that right to represent country people in the future, and that means delivering on our policy areas. So sometimes there are fights and arguments and debates, if you like, within the coalition party room. Our voices are heard. We don't always win those fights, but we always have the fight on behalf of regional people. And I'm confident with the Prime Minister, with Tony Abbott as Prime Minister, he understands the important role the National Party does play, and he does listen to our Deputy Prime Minister and leader Nationals, Warren Truss.
So what would you say the Nationals have achieved during this term?
Well, primarily there's been a focus on delivering for our constituents. So one really significant achievement, and I give credit to the Trade Minister in this regard, is the free trade agreements will be good for regional Australia. We need to explain to regional Australians how they can capitalise on this, how our agricultural exports and others can capitalise on the opportunities that's created. That's been a great achievement.
But he's a Liberal Minister.
But we've worked very closely with Andrew, and that's what I was saying in terms of the coalition agreement and the way we work with the Liberal Party. There are many things we agree on. So that's been a success. The opportunities to have more focus on foreign investment, particularly on agricultural land, is an issue that's been big in regional communities for a long time, and the need to have a register so that we understand exactly the extent of the foreign interest in agricultural land is something that I think is widely accepted now across the Parliament, and that's been, and the Foreign Investment Review Board having a bigger say in some of those purchases is something that regional communities have welcomed. And the infrastructure work that Warren Truss is delivering through his portfolio has been very important, right along, particularly if you look at the Queensland coastline. The work on the Bruce Highway is very significant. If we're going to see Northern Australia grow and become the economic powerhouse that we think it can become, you need to make sure that arterial link is sustained through good weather and bad. At the moment, the Bruce Highway is subject to flooding in too many places, and it cuts off parts of regional Queensland and cuts it off from the capital city of Brisbane. So there's a lot of money going into the infrastructure works. In my electorate of Gippsland, there's been some fantastic work on some highway upgrades, on local road upgrades. I mean, these things might not seem too sexy to people in the city, but out in the country, we love getting better roads. It improves our productivity. It saves lives. It brings our communities together. So we're delivering, and we're working hard and making sure that we get a fair share of whatever government resources are available to country people.
One distinctive feature about the contemporary Nationals is that you're rather more civilised about leadership than either the Liberal Party or the Labor Party. But there has been speculation that Warren Truss mightn't stand for his seat at the next election. If that happens, do you think Barnaby Joyce is a shoo-in for the leadership?
Well, you're right. One of the things about the Nationals is we are a very loyal crew. We're a tight team. We're almost like a family in many regards. And so if you pick a fight with the Nationals, you pick a fight with the whole team at once. And we are strongly and steadfastly supportive of our leader. And Warren has been the leader for 7 years, and he's been terrific for our party. As I mentioned, we've seen growth in our party of 50% since the 2007 election. So I give all credit to Warren and that strong leadership. In terms of what happens next, I mean, old Father Time marches against us all. So we have to acknowledge that at some stage in the future, Warren won't be our leader. But that's not a debate or a discussion we're actively having now. Warren will be the leader for as long as he wants to be the leader. He has incredible support in the party room. You don't have to look very hard to find people willing to endorse him as our leader. He does a great job, and what he does do is give us a great deal of stability. And people underestimate Warren Truss. He's been a quiet achiever for our party in the sense that he's had so many different portfolios. He brings a great depth of corporate knowledge to the government and some real strength around the cabinet table. And I think he'll continue to serve in a very, very distinctive way and a distinguished way for us. And it's up to him what he decides to do in the future.
Let me put it another way. Is Barnaby Joyce the heir apparent?
Well, anyone reading, you know, it's very difficult for a member of parliament in that team to comment on other members of the team. It's a bit unfair to talk about your colleagues too much. But Barnaby has a whole range of characteristics which make him a standout in our party. He's a very colourful figure. He has a way of getting a message out there to regional Australians in a way that is well received. He brings a certain degree of colour and movement to the National Party, and it's good. And Barnaby's a very good friend of mine and a close political colleague. So, you know, I certainly wish him well in whatever his future endeavours are, but I can't really comment on what the party might decide at some time in the future. It is a very hypothetical discussion we're having, and as I've indicated, Warren will be there for as long as Warren wants to be there, and right now I see no signs that Warren's lessening his workload or his achievements for regional Australia. He has been a terrific leader, and I'm sure he'll be a very significant contributor for the remainder of this term of government.
Before we leave leadership, what about your own ambitions? Do you see yourself in the future a leadership position,
well,
leader or deputy?
Look, I'm a bit circumspect on these sorts of questions. I tend to focus on the job I'm doing, and I'm trying to do the best job I can as a member for Gippsland, as a parliamentary secretary for defence, and other things will take care of themselves. If you do your job well, your colleagues might decide that you need a promotion. If you do your job badly, your colleagues might decide you need to go backwards. You're in the lap of the gods in that regard. So I just try and do my job the best I possibly can and let the rest take care of itself.
That's a very modest answer, so we'll move right on. Now, the Nationals in Victoria at the state election had a bad result. Is the party in decline in Victoria?
Well,
long-term decline.
No, I'd have to I'd take a bit exception to the bad result. We did have one seat taken away from us by the Victorian Electoral Commission through the redistribution, so that meant we lost one lower house member, and we had a poor result in Shepparton. So I'd acknowledge that there were some negatives that come out of it. One of the really big positives to come out of it was the election of two young women in the seat of Lowen and the seat of Euroa. So they were very strong performances, and in fact, one of those young women, Steph Ryan, has been made the deputy leader in Victoria in her first term. That's a really good, strong show of confidence. So I think the party in Victoria is going through a rebuilding phase. We had a long-term leader in Peter Ryan who's now left the parliament, and on the weekend we held his seat in a by-election, in a hotly contested by-election. The Nationals' Danny O'Brien won that seat from the Liberal Party, from the Greens. It's interesting that Labor didn't even stand. And the two-party preferred vote in that election was 75% to 25%. Again, Liberal National versus the Greens. So we'd have to say that was a good result, and we're going through that rebuilding phase. You know, the Nationals are always challenged by geography. We are, you know, as the cities get bigger and regional areas are under pressure, it makes it harder for us. But look, I think the party will rebuild from that experience. We've been in worse positions in Victoria and come back strongly from it. We'd like to be in a little bit better position, let's be honest. We'd like to have held a couple more seats in Victoria, but that's the same at a federal level. We were down to 14 seats in 2007, 2008, and now we're back up to 21 when you count the reps and senators together. So we have shown a capacity and an extraordinary resilience over the past 100 years. People have written us off many, many times in the past, and we've always come back.
And what are you hearing from New South Wales, where, of course, we've got an election at the end of the month?
Again, the New South Wales team has had a change of leader, so, and that's always an exciting time in the party. So Andrew Stoner, who'd been a long-serving leader, and now we have Troy Grant taking over the reins, and all I'm hearing is positive things. The New South Wales team had a fantastic result at the last election. When you have a great result like that, the challenge is always then to hang on to those seats at the subsequent election. So they're fighting very hard. I'm sort of a bit removed from it, so I'm only seeing it sort of secondhand. But what I'm seeing is a lot of activity on the ground. It's probably the opportunity there for those Nationals who've come in their first term in New South Wales is to prove themselves to the electorates. And I think from what I've seen of their work effort, they'll be rewarded if they've delivered for their people. And country people are very loyal. If you work hard for them, if you do the right thing and you deliver for their community, they will reward you at the ballot box. So I think the New South Wales Nationals are in a strong position. I think their new leader is taking them in the right direction, and I think they'll be well rewarded at the election on March 28th.
Just looking to the federal election, one of the interesting seats is Indi, where Cathy McGowan, the Independent, sees that from the Liberals last time. So that'll be an open contest within coalition circles next time round. Do you think that the Nationals will be tempted to run?
Well, you're right. It will be a fascinating seat. Cathy McGowan is an independent, has taken what is probably territory that the Nationals and the Liberal Party would both argue is their own type of territory. So you've got to give credit to the independent in that regard. She's earned the right to be in the parliament, but because it is an open seat in terms of the coalition agreement, you'd think that both parties will show a great deal of interest in it. Undoubtedly, the Liberal Party will run, and there's lots of rumours about who may or may not contest that. And I can say from our perspective in the Nationals, we are very keen to expand our representation in the House. We see our capacity to grow as a party means a seat like Indi is the type of seat we should be looking at very closely. A lot of this depends, though, on the availability of candidates and the response you receive from the electorate. If the electorate wants us, we'll turn up. We've had a bit of interest from candidates already who've contacted our state secretary and shown their interest. So I think it's one that's under active consideration. But it'd be premature of me to say we'll definitely run. But I think it's one that it's a type of seat the Nationals would have ambitions to hold in the past. Given we've it's one we'd like to hold in the future, given we have held in the past.
Now, coal seam gas exploration has been quite a big issue for the Nationals and more generally, and you got into an argument recently about it with former Howard Government Minister Peter Reith during the state by-election that you were talking about. Where do you stand on this? And is this an issue that divides the two parties?
Which parties?
The Nationals and the
Liberals. Oh, okay. Look, it's coal seam gas is a very difficult issue in our communities because of some of the emotion that's been attached to the debate in the absence of facts and science. And I think the Greens in particular have been somewhat irresponsible in the way they've approached this issue. I've had, rallies in my electorate where there's been pictures of children wearing gas masks as if it's some sort of mustard gas attack as of World War One, and that's very irresponsible. And I think that's entirely inappropriate. I'm very critical of them for doing that. But our view in the Nationals has always been there is a need to hasten slowly, take the time to get the science right. We've argued for many years now that the environmental protocols need to be set very high for this, particularly in terms of the water table. So if there's any risk to water, we've said that would be a deal breaker in terms of coal seam gas. We've also argued in terms of a policy principle that if it does go ahead, if it's found to be a viable resource, then there's got to be a reasonable return to the individual landowner, but also a reasonable return to the community which is accommodating the coal seam gas development. And then in recent times, the Victorian state team has released a policy position where they've argued there should be a right of veto for individual landowners as well. And that is a further step along the path of where the federal team's been for several years. I don't think there is much division between Liberals and Nationals on this. It's a contentious issue in many regional communities. In my electorate of Gippsland, there's a moratorium in place now while the state government does more work on the science. But when you talk to people in your community and listen to their concerns, they're more comforted if they're convinced that the science and the research is going to go in. The emotional arguments being put by the Greens, actually, it's been to the detriment of our communities. And as we saw on the weekend in Gippsland South, the 75-25 vote against the Greens is an indication that the community of Gippsland, regional communities, don't want Green members of Parliament.
In your portfolio area, obviously submarines has been a big and contentious issue recently. Would the Nationals be happy to have Australia's new submarines built in Japan?
Well, we're jumping a long way down the conversation to get to that point. The Prime Minister has announced and the Defence Minister has announced the competitive evaluation process where foreign nations will be invited, along with the Australian Submarine Corporation, to put their wares forward, if you like, on what they can deliver to Australia. This debate has been hijacked a bit by a lack of recognition that when we're talking about something which may be in the order of a $50 billion contract, up to two-thirds of that contract will be the sustainment and the work that's done on maintaining that fleet into the future. We seem to be addressing this issue as if it's an all or nothing where the submarines are built, when in fact there's a lot of work, a lot of jobs that are going to go into the sustainment of these submarines regardless of where they're built. So look, in answer to your question, there's a lot of processes that need to happen first. And I don't want to be someone who's always criticising the Labor Party, but they had several years, they had 6 or 7 years to actually do something about submarines, and they put it in the too hard basket. So we are playing catch up, but it's a big decision that the government has to make. It's a capability that the Defence Force needs. We need to make sure there is no capability gap from when the Collins class goes out of service to when the new submarine comes into action. But we're talking about something that's going to provide for our Defence Forces for 30 odd years. This is a major decision for a government to make, and it's one that we should take our time to get right. But in the longer term, we need to acknowledge there are a lot of jobs associated with the sustainment of whichever submarine we build and wherever it's built.
The bells that you hear are Parliament starting to gather. Now, you've been a long-time domestic campaigner on domestic violence, and recently you were suggesting that what was needed was a big gesture similar to the apology to Indigenous people. What form do you think that could take?
Well, I did make the case, and it has been reported publicly, that in addition to the hard work on the ground by our police and family services organisations, that some sort of grand gesture or big gesture, as it's referred to, in relation to domestic violence would actually help to draw more attention to the debate. And I have suggested one. Perhaps we could get the Australian of the Year, Rosie Batty, to address the House of Parliament or both Houses of Parliament. Rosie Batty was in Parliament only a matter of 2 weeks ago, and she addressed a room. By my count, there's about 45 members and senators there. And you could have heard a pin drop. She is a compelling woman. She tells her story incredibly well. She's made it very clear that the violence that occurred in her life will not define her. It will be her reaction to it, and her reaction to that has been something that has, I think, really helped to shape the debate and reset the debate in Australia. I think the Prime Minister's decision to appoint former Victorian Police Commissioner Ken Lay in his national advisory role in relation to family violence is another huge step forward. I think this debate is one that will go on. It needs to be continually talked about in the open. This is an issue for all Australians, but particularly for men. We have an appalling rate of violence in our family homes. This year, it's close to 2 women per week have been killed by their partner or their former partner, by men who pretend or claim to love them. So these are issues we have to deal with.
Now, just finally, before you race off to the House, you recently praised Mickey. Just finally, before you race off to the House, you recently praised Ricky Muir's first speech. Do you think that the Parliament needs more ordinary grassroots MPs coming through rather than former staffers, people very educated in the political process?
Yeah, look, that's a terrific question. I see a lot of Ricky Muir people in my electorate. People just like Ricky. He's a genuine fella.
Well, even Ricky Muir, because isn't he setting up his office?
Yes, that's true. Ricky is in my electorate.
Taking over your old office.
That's right. No, Ricky actually lives in my electorate, but I see a lot of people like Ricky Muir in my electorate. He's as in the dealings I've had with him, he's a decent, hard-working family man. In many ways, he's an accidental senator. He probably never expected to become a senator, but he is one now, and he's going to be there for another 5 years. And I think he has a good deal of country common sense that can offer something to the Senate. You know, his hobbies and interests aren't unlike a lot of people in my electorate. He's into four-wheel driving. He likes camping. He's worked in a timber mill. He's a genuine fella. You know, no one's going to pretend he's got all the answers to the issues of the day, but none of us do, really. I think he does bring a bit of a refreshing working class background to the Senate. In terms of whether we're getting enough diversity in the House, I think it's a fair question. I mean, the Labor Party in particular seems to have a production line of union officials, former staffers get into the role. And to some extent, that criticism is valid of the coalition as well now, where a lot of our members of Parliament do come from an electorate background or have worked for a former minister. So I think we do need to have diversity. And that one of our real challenges in our political parties now is getting more people involved at the grassroots level, because we're not getting enough people actually joining political parties now. Now, you can't, as a member of a political party, just complain about it. You've got to actually start working with the grassroots and say, well, why don't you join us? What is it that we're not offering you anymore that you used to join our parties? And now, in our party, in the National Party, we have a strong representation of regional people, but we're quite an old party. We need to find ways to get younger people and more women involved in our party.
Darren Chester, thanks for talking with us today. We'll let you get to your parliamentary duties.
I was saved by God to make America great again.
An autocrat loves a crisis. A crisis is the way that they mobilize their base.
While America is under invasion from within, we're under invasion from within.
He's testing the boundaries of what he can get away with.
We should use some of these dangerous cities as training grounds for our military, National Guard, but military.
We've asked six of the world's preeminent scholars how we can measure the make of an autocrat. It's a recipe of sorts, tried and tested by the most infamous leaders in history.
Hugo Chavez in Venezuela.
Vladimir Putin in Russia.
Joseph Stalin and Adolf Hitler.
Viktor Orban in Hungary.
He's basically bulletproof in terms of criminal prosecution.
Join us from December 29 as we explore Trump, the making of an autocrat, from The Conversation.